Thank you for joining me for the first episode of Season 3 of Law and Religion Down Under, a podcast devoted to covering the interactions of law and religion in the South Pacific. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. Our topic for today is religious freedom in Indonesia, and we're fortunate to be joined by an expert on the subject. Robert Hefner is professor of anthropology at Boston University and the former director of the university's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. He has published or edited over 20 books on religion and politics, Islam and citizenship, and Muslim history and civilization, and has also produced several documentaries on the politics of religion and citizenship in Indonesia. His article, Islam and Institutional Religious Freedom in Indonesia, appeared last year in an issue of the academic journal Religions. Professor Hefner, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
For maybe just to get us started, for listeners who don't know much about the sort of interaction between the state and religion in Indonesia, how would you describe it in a sort of capsule summary?
Well, Indonesia is a Muslim-majority country where 87.2 or 87.3% of the population is officially Muslim. That's the first point. About 10%, it's just a tad under 10% of the population is Christian. And then you have smaller minorities of Buddhists, Hindus, and Confucians. There are six recognized religions that are treated as equal as far as citizenship documents and those sorts of things are concerned. And religion is something you are required to have. There is, out of the gate, perhaps the most distinctive feature of religious freedom in Indonesia. Those two things. Number one, six religions are recognized. Number two, everybody has to have a religion. And that's from birth. You have to self-identify as having one of those six religions. Now, that said, that compromise with the six recognized religions was reached, if you will, in the face of a long history of contention as to whether Islam should be, you know, the state religion or given a special priority. And it's this model of Pancasila, the five principles of Indonesia, that has prevailed.
Okay. Well, I'm very interested in the registration of religious affiliation. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But first, on your earlier point, you mentioned that there's maybe a sort of tension between one of the largest democratic countries in the region, a tension between sort of Islamists and more pluralist sort of understandings of religion since the fall of Suharto. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That, in fact, that cuts to the chase of what is perhaps the most important point as regards religious freedom in Indonesia. In the aftermath of the fall of Suharto in May 1998, there was a widespread expectation, as there had been in the 1950s, as well the middle of the 1950s, there was a widespread expectation that the country might go, if not in an Islamist direction, in somewhat more of a Muslim majoritarian direction, if I can use that phrase, a political system, which even if Islam is not the official religion of state or the primary religion of state, as it is in Malaysia, it nonetheless enjoys a special status as first among those six recognized religions. So you have that long history. But very quickly out of the gate, the Indonesian National Assembly passed a series of laws which I think were widely recognized as affirming a decidedly more open and pluralist understanding of religious freedom. Not pluralist in the American, if I can put it this way, in the Anglo-American sense of you can be any religion you want to be. There is a difference here. That Indonesia is not Anglo-American liberal in its understanding of religious freedom, not to be too technical about that. It has an understanding of religious freedom. It's multi-confessional, but it does at the same time require everyone to have a religion. And as a kind of way to bring the somewhat more Islamist-oriented population into the pact that has sustained Indonesia since the return to democracy, there's a good deal of official state support for those six religions, beginning with the fact that you have to have a religion, but also extending to things like in all public schools, every child has to undergo 3 hours of religious instruction per week in the religion of his or her self-declared faith.
Okay, so On the legally recognized religions, I think the list is Islam, Protestantism, Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism. I have a lot of questions about this because I do find it really an interesting aspect of law and religion in Indonesia. I guess my first question is, why these six? Where did these six come from of, you know, all the various religions in the world? How did Indonesia settle on these particular ones?
It settled on them through, I think, a combined process of government statistic taking, which over the years, at first in the 1950s, it recorded the government statistics on everybody who was born. It recorded their religion, but it did not require, in the early 1950s, it did not require everybody to self-identify with those six. That process emerged as, again, part of the political give and take between political parties of a more Islamist, I don't mean extremist, but of an Islamist variety. And by Islamist, I mean a Muslim who thinks the state should be based on Islam, and it shouldn't be based on something like the Pancasila, which has certain religious elements, but it is by no means an Islamic document or body of principles. So the state moved from very early on, if you will, encouraging religious affiliation, but not fully having resolved those six as the major religions. And then in the early 1960s, as politics in Indonesia took a very dark turn, this is in a period when the Indonesian Communist Party is the largest in the world, and needless to say, the Muslim community, but also one should remember the Catholic and Christian minority, today about just under 10% of the population, they were not happy with this either. They weren't ferocious anti-communists, but the Cold War was on. And so the paradox of Indonesia, not the paradox, but the kind of remarkable feature of Indonesia at this time is that the Muslim parties and the Catholics worked in close, Catholics and Protestants worked in relatively close alliance. But as we get to the early 1960s, the Communist Party is just booming and it becomes the largest party in Indonesia. This creates a tension in the Muslim community, and one that the political polarization actually contributed to the ascendance, relatively speaking, of a more conservative, even quasi-Islamist element. We then get to 65, 66, the bloodshed, the destruction of the Communist Party. At least 500,000 people die. Indonesia looks like a country which is the least likely to develop any system of democracy or pluralist tolerance in the world. But for a variety of reasons, which we can go into later if you're interested, it slowly but surely emerges from this maelstrom and develops, lays the foundation for a democracy movement that ultimately in 1998, May 98, removes the authoritarian President Suharto from power. But more importantly, it laid theological, principled grounds in all of the major faith communities for getting together, you know, mobilizing around and supporting, committing oneself to the Pancasila rather than the idea of an Islamic state. So those six religions, they're the major players. And it was, if you will, a kind of general political process more than it was a kind of, you know, principled social science analysis.
So from I guess an individual perspective on the ground, if I'm Jewish or I'm a Sikh or, you know, I'm an atheist, what happens to me if I'm a citizen of Indonesia? How do I sort of navigate the world?
Let's go with the small, tiny Jewish community that exists in Indonesia. It's actually just probably a few hundred or perhaps 2,000 people, most of them living around the East Javanese city of Surabaya. And they're people mostly of mixed Euro and then Indonesian descent. And I've actually I've come to know them just really over the last 5 or 6 years, even though my own research many decades ago was primarily in East Java, I didn't actually understand that there was a Jewish population. So I've asked these Jewish Indonesians, what's your situation? You're not one of the six recognized religions. And the answer is interesting. The answer is, well, we might want greater accommodation for Jews as Indonesian citizens and recognized religions. But our status is one that we will, under the circumstances, accept and recognize as helpful and healthy. What is that status? Sikhism, S-I-K-H-I-S-M, Judaism, and Baha'ism are all recognized religions that are accommodated, so that they're recognized by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, which is a very important bureau in Indonesia. It's the second largest after the Ministry of Defense. It's huge. So the Ministry of Religious Affairs recognizes those religions, but it does not include those religions among the six that are provided special resources and bureaus within the Ministry of Religious Affairs. But that said, if you are born a Sikh, and there is a much larger Sikh community in Indonesia than Jews, you can have Sikhism put on your card in some provinces, your population card. It varies by, there's not a uniform regulation. It's one of these things that Indonesians talk about, but there is, I think, on the part of Sikhs, on the part of Jews, this very tiny Jewish community, and some other people, some among the Baha'i, a relative sense that, well, it could be better, but we are treated fairly well. Mm. The big exception, and I'll stop here, the community that probably has had the least accommodation under this six religions plus the others system are those people like the once large community of people in Kalimantan, Java, and parts of Sumatra who profess some kind of indigenous religion. And this is the subject of great discussion since the Constitutional Court ruling in 2017, which surprised many people, including me. These groups, which are referred to as beliefs, kepercayaan, these groups have, for the first time, been given a greater measure of accommodation. Now there are even textbooks issued by the Ministry of Education that provide a basic primer on, if you're a member of an indigenous religion or a kepercayaan group, here you go. Here's what you can teach in schools. That doesn't mean you can put a kepercayaan on your passport or on any number of the other documents for school registration, cemetery burials, and all those sorts of things. So there's not an absolute equality, but there's some very interesting movement taking place in Indonesia. And one that I think testifies, my last comment here, it actually testifies to the fact that the Ministry of Religious Affairs in Indonesia has a very large number of very sophisticated democratic intellectuals. I'll just put it there. Okay. Very serious, very well-trained, very thoughtful intellectuals.
Now, I guess looking at the flip side, if I am a member of one of the six official religions, you mentioned there are some benefits that come with that. Are there hindrances? For example, if I'm a Protestant, can I marry a Buddhist? Am I able to buy property in every area of Indonesia? Or are there limitations that come with or between, I guess, the different recognized religions?
Well, we have to distinguish, as would be the case in much of the world, we have to distinguish between legal and constitutional provisions and then actual social interactions and realities, which are unfortunately, as in my own United States, are not always in full conformity with legal principles. Legally, those rights of ownership to land and voting rights, those are regulated by different laws, and they are equalized for all citizens. There is not discrimination in any formal legal sense on matters of land ownership or matters like that. When we move into issues of marriage, however, interreligious marriage, there are restrictions. Mm. This too is an issue on which there's been some movement in recent years, but the general trend has been for marriages are regulated not under the Department of Interior, they're regulated by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, except for those, for some communities who ask that their marriages be right, that and that. It's not the Muslims who ask that their marriage just be regulated in civic courts. So it's a complicated situation. And when a Muslim wants to marry a non-Muslim, that in particular, and I would say in particular, above all else, when a Muslim and a Christian want to marry, in some provinces, you're going to encounter, now we move from the legislative to the social reality, you're going to encounter some state officials who will discourage that or say, oh, that's against the law. In other places, I know this from Central Java because I worked in Yogyakarta. I've also worked for many years in East Java. But there would be people who would come from other parts of the country to Central Java to marry because they knew in Central Java, the court system was much more, where marriages are registered and all, was much more accommodating to interreligious unions. So there's, you know, there's a kind of fuzzy area here.
And would you say, is there sort of a lot of social pressure or social hostility against interfaith relationships?
In some parts of those religious communities, yes. I think most strongly, there's no question that the major cleavage in Indonesia that is most charged, and I don't want to make too much of it. It's actually pretty good in much of the country, but in some parts of the country, it's the Muslim-Christian relations which are more heavily charged than, for example, in a place like Bali. Bali is, you know, only 1.5% or 1.2% of the population of Indonesia is Hindu, but 92% or 90% of the population of Bali, which has about just under 3 million people, is Hindu. And the Hindu population and the Muslims in Bali tend to be, I don't want to make too much of this, but they tend to be a little bit more tolerant of interreligious marriages. But in the Muslim society, and I would say Christian society, there's a good deal of social pressure from your own community, more than from the state. Though there are some state restrictions, as you just heard me say, in some provinces, officials going to say, oh, no, you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that. So there's a lot of variation, but the real source of pressure, there's no question about it, comes from those respective religious communities, Christian, Catholic Christian, and Muslim. And okay. Only wings within each, but they're well-organized wings, and they can at sometimes raise their voices.
I can understand that. Well, that does help explain the situation, because when I went to Indonesia for an academic conference and I presented on the registration of religions, and, you know, from a traditional sort of liberal perspective, it sounds bizarre to have a specified list of religions and everybody has to belong to one of those religions on the list. So I presented my, you know, standard liberal critique, and it was received politely, but no one ever mentioned it again. And so I just find that the situation very interesting and the origins of it. And I'm curious whether you think, is there, you mentioned maybe perhaps with the indigenous beliefs, is there room for that list in the future to be expanded, or is that such a sort of core part of Indonesian identity, or, you know, six identities, that it's likely to remain fixed like that?
I think I can say with confidence that it's going to remain a matter of considerable uncertainty. So I'm confident. But I'm confident about uncertainty. There's no question, and I can say this from personal knowledge of high-ranking officials in the Ministry of Religious Affairs, Muslim officials, there's a number of people who would like a more open and even more plural system. Nobody wants to get, virtually nobody in Indonesia thinks the requirement of having religion is something that should be done away with. Now, there are some people, and there was a controversial case, a very sad case some years ago of a state official in Sumatra who said he was an atheist. And he was a state official, and he was the subject of again, fierce societal pushback. So to declare yourself an atheist in Indonesia, for a whole series of reasons, which I won't try to explain right now, has very, very negative connotations. And I think for those of us who just want to understand Indonesia, I'm not trying to make an argument one way or another, we have to appreciate that this is part of Indonesian cultural history and political history, that it's led to this way. Now, that said, on the more specific point as to whether the number of religions may be expanded, if I had to call the general trajectory of Indonesia over the next 15 years, my bet, but it would be a very qualified bet, would be there will be an expansion. Huh. It will begin with groups like the Baha'i, who, even though they're just a small group, and even though, of course, in some parts of the world, not least Iran, the Baha'i are seen as apostates from Islam. Baha'ism just emerged in the 19th century, and most of its early recruits were people who had been born Muslim in Iran. And now it's found in other societies like Indonesia. But in Indonesia, the Baha'i are actually, according to the Baha'i I know, are well respected. They're not seen as apostates. So I think Baha'ism, I think Sikhism, and then some varieties of these groups we call Kepercayaan, which are actually a lot of different groups, I think they could be acknowledged and given, if you will, a more formal representation in bureaus in the Ministry of Religious Affairs. And I say this, my last sentence here, I say this because, take for the example, the Kepercayaan, the belief groups, the indigenous religion groups. The Ministry of Education over the last 6 years has developed a very impressive, very tolerant body of curricular materials to support this community, even though they're not part of the six. So you can see some bureaus in government are already kind of advocating or pressing for a relaxation of that six religions regulation.
Okay. And maybe I guess along maybe a broader theme along those lines, how would you describe the sort of cultural, the level of cultural, we might say, conservatism in the country as it pertains to, for example, gender equality or sexual orientation? I know often in the West, we have a stereotype of predominantly Muslim countries as being very hardline on these questions. How would you describe the sort of street level way that these issues are handled in Indonesia?
Well, I'll start with the bad news from a Western liberal perspective and a Western gender pluralist, if we can use that phrase, perspective, LGBTQ plus. The bad news is that LGBTQ issues and the kind of robust gender pluralism, going beyond gender binarism, that view has, if you will, come to be seen by the Islamist portion of the population. And I think in terms of percentages, we're talking about 25% of the public, not the majority. But this has been turned into a political issue, much as in the United States of America, if I may say so, LGBTQ issues have been politicized. They become a kind of key marker of the difference between progressive liberals and then a whole slew of conservatives, some of whom are not all that conservative on some issues, but because LGBTQ gender pluralism issues have been pluralized and been turned into such a critical red line in places like the United States, I think in some ways the hardness of the opposition, the conservative opposition, has become greater. And among the 25% or so of the Indonesian public who's broadly Islamist, not extremist, not violent, but they want, they want something more than the Pancha Seal of the five principles and this sort of equitable treatment of the six religions and now coming to include, accommodations for Sikhs and Baha'i and all and the belief groups. So they for this community, which feels somewhat aggrieved, they feel that, they've been outdone in the elections by the other group, the more, let's call them pluralist Democrats. They're not liberal Democrats in the American, Anglo-American or Australian sense, but they're pluralist Democrats. very real. And that this, the aggrieved 25% have turned LGBTQ issues into a red line. So it's in some ways the issue for LGBTQ people has become more sensitive. Now that said, I actually have an Indonesian researcher, a woman, a young woman, who's doing research on just these issues right now in Indonesia. And the other thing that's happened is that the LGBTQ community has actually become better organized. And in some parts of the country, but it varies widely, in some parts of the country, they're much more above ground, in the open, vocal, and to a certain degree, even tolerated than they would have been, you know, 15 or so years ago. So it's a comp. But if you went to Aceh, the province in North Sumatra that is professes a somewhat more, I would say, yes, somewhat more sexually conservative and socially conservative variety of Islam than even most of the rest of the country. If you go there and you try to organize an LGBTQ demonstration, you might encounter some hostility or some pushback from not just the government, the local government, but from society. So it's a complicated situation, but it's, let me just end with a brief comment on women. And specific, so leaving aside LGBTQ issues, which as you've heard me say, are they're in flux, but they're very complicated and they're politicized. Issues of women's equity, I think there we can say, despite the efforts of conservative Islamists to push back on the great gender reforms that were instituted in the first years of the democratic era after Suharto's resignation in May 1998, I think the message there is one of not unilinear progress, but consistent progress nonetheless. Final, just quick illustration, Aisha is the women's organization within the modernist Muslim Muhammadiyah organization. This is the second largest of the Muslim organizations in Indonesia. Aisha has a 12-board executive that I've met with several times. They are unstinting in their commitment to women's equality, women's health, women's education, women's employment outside the home. So there's, even within mainstream Muslim organizations, there has been nothing less, if I can talk about the 30 plus years that I've worked in Indonesia, there's been just a remarkable sea change. And those positions for women, for women's equity, these are not controversial. These are mainstream in the Indonesian Muslim community and in Indonesian Muslim, in Indonesian society as a whole.
And do you notice a large sort of urban-rural divide in attitudes towards these issues like we might find in the United States or some other countries? Or is it more based sort of province and province based on religious concentration, perhaps?
It's a little bit of both, but I think the more decisive factor is province.
Okay.
And the provinces do vary. I mentioned before on interreligious marriage, Central Java and the special district of Yogyakarta, which is also in Central Java, have long been regarded as more flexible and tolerant of interreligious marriage. So the people come. So, and so too on sex and gender issues, there's considerable provincial variation. There's some urban rural, and that, I mean, I'm a sociologist and anthropologist after all, and I spent a number of years living in the countryside. Most of my work today is in the big cities, Jakarta and Yogyakarta. And there is a difference, but that it's actually in some regards surprising how much urban culture and the culture of reform, for instance, with regards to women's education, has really reached into the countryside. Indonesia's, you know, particularly Java, but Bali and parts of Sumatra as well, is very densely populated. And in some regards, that the old urban-rural divide has diminished greatly, and you have just a population that's considerably more mobile, has relatives. Rural people have, almost all have relatives in cities. So there's been a slackening of that simple division.
And you've mentioned a couple of times that Indonesian democracy isn't sort of Western liberal democracy. how would you describe sort of the distinctive features of Indonesian democracy? You mentioned the five principles or Pancasila. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Well, it begins even before then. It's the Pancasila. Pancasila means literally the five principles. And these are principles that include an Indonesian variety of democracy, social justice for all. Ketuhanan, the critical one as far as religious discussions go, is that one of the five principles is godliness, a term which from the term in Indonesia, ketuhanan. Tuhan means God. So that actually it's an official principle of the five principles, which incidentally, remember, go back to the 1950s. President Sukarno, who was a left-leaning nationalist, is the person who worked this out largely to kind of push back against Islamist demands for an Islamic state. So he could say, ah, you see, we're recognizing your religion. But that is that difference, even though it emerged as out of that emphasis on godliness rather than Islam as the religion of state, the emphasis on the state promoting religion, but not just Islam, it is significant. It isn't just a ploy or something that, you know, the Muslim community devises. There's within the Muslim community, including most, not least of all, within Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah, the two largest Muslim social welfare organizations in Indonesia, but also the two largest Muslim civil society associations in the world. In both of these huge organizations, there's a wide variety of opinion, but without question, the main current of opinion, the majority current, is a commitment to pluralist Pancasila democracy, not an Islamic state. There is one of the differences between Indonesia and most of, not all, but most of the Arab Middle East. So there's that. But there's also, just to make the liberal, if I can make this distinction between what I call, and it's just my phrasing, more of a civil democratic tradition as opposed to a liberal democratic tradition. The civil democratic tradition works to strike a balance between group rights and individual rights. Now, when you look at places like Canada, especially where you have a First Nations tradition, they do something very similar. And I would say, even though Canada is very Anglo-liberal in terms of its heritage on some points, such as the way in which it deals with First Nations, Native Americans in particular, it's made an interesting adjustment that's a little different from that with which we classically associate Anglo-American liberalism. So that recognition of group identities and certain group interests, that's, I think, the most important distinction between a modern, in particular, post-1960s liberalism and, if you will, the civil democratic tradition of Indonesia. It has significant liberal elements, but it also accommodates and recognizes group rights, group identities, and, if you will, public good concerns to a greater degree than is the case in, again, my own United States.
Okay. And it sounds from the conversation that you're optimistic that this sort of understanding will continue, and that it's unlikely that sort of a hardcore Islamist faction would be elected in Indonesia.
Well, yes. That I'm optimistic about Indonesia. Let me just begin with that.
Okay.
At the same time, I look at my own country, and I'm not, you know, I'm an independent. I have worked for the State Department at various times for various projects, ones that included, you know, periods when the Republican Party had the presidency, the White House, and others when it was Democrat. So I tried always to be neutral and multi-party in my own orientation. Yet look what has happened in the United States. I don't say this is something about Republicans. I say about the Trump phenomenon as being far outside my expectations. So, and that's been, if you will, a kind of salutary lesson for me in reflecting on democracy everywhere. Democracy in an age of social media, in an age of these of hoaxes and misinformation, when promoted by people who are powerful and well connected by way of new social media, democracy, I think, has new varieties, new vulnerabilities. Is Indonesia immune to those? Well, since my own country, the United States, has not been, I think I'd be reluctant to say Indonesia is entirely immune. But that said, this is a country that went through awful, awful political economic crisis from the late 1950s through 1966, was under authoritarian rule for 32 years, and yet developed a Muslim majority commitment, and it is a majority commitment, to the principles of Pancasila. The Christian community is there with the Muslim community, as are the much smaller Hindu and Buddhist minorities. Who knows, you know, if something could, you know, a certain kind of politics like that, which we saw in my own United States, could emerge in Indonesia. But I think right now, Indonesia looks like a very healthy place. Very unequal in some regards. Economic development in some of the provinces has been marked by the same high rates of inequality that you see in places like the Philippines and Thailand, most of Asia and most of the Middle East. But in terms of this political commitments and political aspirations, this commitment to a multi-religious and multi-ethnic Indonesia, I think it's going to hold.
Okay, well, we'll probably wrap up on that note, because I always like to end on something that sounds hopeful, and it sounds like from your perspective, Indonesia is on the right track as it pertains to freedom of religion. So thank you so much for coming on today. I know there were some time zone challenges that made it particularly hard for you, so I very much appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
That concludes this episode of Law and Religion Down Under. You'll find links to more information about Professor Heppner's research in the show notes. As always, if you have comments or topic suggestions, please email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au, and I'll be back in 2 months with another episode. Thanks for listening.